I will look again at the book of Job. It's a little further on tonight. Last study, we got to the end of chapter 5. Tonight we're going into chapters 6 and 7. Now let me catch up again with some of the things we have learned. Chapter 1 and 2 is the introduction to the whole book. In fact, it's the foundation. If we miss the truths that are found in the first two chapters, we'll not understand the book at all. You remember that there was a controversy going on behind the scenes. Satan was accusing God and accusing Job. Says, you've hedged that man around. If it wasn't for that, if it wasn't for the blessings you've poured on him, why, he wouldn't want anything to do with you. He'd curse you to your face. And down comes Satan. He let you go against Job as his trials. But he didn't curse God. And again, he's accused. Let me put my finger on him. You've taken away his goods, you've taken away his family. A man will give his possessions, he'll even give his family, but touch him and he'll curse you to your face. And you know what happened in chapter 2. Poor man is stricken with disease. He's a man who has lost all his possessions, lost his home, as it were, lost his family, big family, lost them all. His wife has turned against him. At last his friends came along at the end of chapter 2. At least they were supposed to be his friends. Later on, Job calls them miserable comforters. Now we keep this in mind. They came with the intention of bringing him some comfort. It's obvious they must have heard about it. And they consulted with one another, even if they lived in different places, and they got together. They came the distance, and they came over to see him. But when they saw him, they hadn't a word to say to him. They sat for a whole week, never uttered a word to him. But I think as I read through these chapters, I'm convinced of this in my own soul, that they had consultations with each other. They consulted with themselves as to what each one thought about Job, because they all arrived at the same conclusion. They arrived at this conclusion that somewhere, unknown to them, there was secret sin in the life of Job. They were convinced of that. And so therefore, because of his secret sin, God had withdrawn the blessings from him. And God was punishing him. When you come to chapter 3, Job has suffered it long enough, and he bursts out with a great lamentation. And they listened to his lamentation. I suggested to you when we looked at chapter 3, it always reminds me of what I call Job's Gethsemane. You know, when the Lord was in Gethsemane, he had gone a little further than the rest, and was in an agony of soul. He prayed the more earnestly, and sweat, as it were, drops of blood falling to the ground. That to me seems to be the picture in chapter 3 here of Job. A man who's down in the depths of sorrow. He bursts out and he complains. And listen. And after he's finished, Eliphaz begins to speak. I take it that he's the oldest of the three men. He speaks first. In chapters 4 and 5, he gives Job what you and I would call a big mouthful. Doesn't speak a word of comfort to him at all. He reproaches him. And you remember some of the things for which he reproached him. The main one was this. Now Job, You have been a man and you have sought to comfort others. When others were in difficulty and in trouble, you were the man that came and tried to give them support and succor. You tried to help them. But the strange thing is, you who set yourself up to help others, when the same things come to you, you can't help yourself. You sink down in despair. I don't know if you folks have ever thought of that. Because I have known other people who have admitted to me that they themselves tried to comfort other people who were going through difficulties, but when they themselves were faced with mighty difficulties, it got them down. They just couldn't take it. Now that's what Eliphaz is telling Job. You. Suggesting now that you are worse than them. And you've gone down, you're sinking into despair. And yet you pretended to comfort others. Then he goes on from there and he says, now look, there's a certain principle in God's realm. It's the principle of sowing and reaping. You're reaping something now, Job. You must have been sowing something. There's secret sin in your life and God is dealing with you. Now, you know, it's easy to arrive at that conclusion when people are suffering. But do you remember what I said? Keep this principle in mind. You can never arrive at a proper conclusion of a matter until you know all the facts. If you don't know all the facts, you can't make a decision. And these men didn't know the facts. Again, much that Eliphaz says is true. Many of the things he's expressing are true. But they were misapplied. They were not true concerning Job. They may have been true concerning others. And now this man claims, he said, you know, all this has come to me in a kind of vision. I've had a revelation of these things. I have an understanding of these things. And I know that what you're passing through, you must have some secret sin hidden somewhere in the cupboard. Poor Job. He listens to all this. He waits till this man is finished. Then that brings us to chapter 6. And here's Job now, he lifts his head. And he's going to give his answer to this first philosopher who has spoken to him. Let us read the first 7 verses of this chapter. The Job answered and said, oh, that my grief were thoroughly weighed, my calamity laid in the balances together. For now, it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Therefore my words are swallowed up, for the arrows of the Almighty are within me. The poison whereof drinketh up my spirit. The terrors of God do set themselves in array against me. Doth the wild ass bray when he hath grass? Or loweth the ox over his fodder? Can that which is unsavory be eaten without salt? Or is there any taste in the white of an egg? The things that my soul refused to touch are as my sorrowful meat. Let's stop there a moment or two. Let's see what Job is getting at now. You see, back in chapter 3, Job sinks down into despair. I've indicated in chapters 4 and 5, Eliphaz reproaches Job for this, for being in despair. Now in chapter 6, Job gives his reasons for his despair. He's trying to be reasonable with the man who's accusing him. He said, oh, if I could only get my grief weighed, and my calamity laid in the balances, in plain words. If you could possibly take the measure of my grief, put it in the balance, take the measure of my calamity, put them in the balance. you would see that my grief is just comparable to what I've passed through, that's all. In fact, he says, for now it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. Who could weigh the sand of the sea? Now he says, the trouble it with you is this, you're accusing me. You think that I'm grieving too much. The fact is you don't understand my grief. You don't understand the cause of my grief. You don't understand the measure of my grief. Neither do you understand the measure of my calamity that I've come through. He had lost 7 sons and 3 daughters. He lost all his goods. His business was wrecked and bankrupt. And he had lost his health. His wife had turned against him. He was left alone. No one to share his awful sigh. He said, oh, if only you could understand. If only you could put these things in the proper balance and weigh them. Then you understand. For example, he says, think those wild asses that roam the wilderness. Have you ever heard them braying when they had plenty of food? As long as they're being fed, they don't bray. It's only when they're in need, only when things have gone against them that they bray. What about the ox? Does the ox make its noise? Does it lower while it's feeding? No. It's when it's in need you hear the cattle lowing. But as long as they're being fed, they're quiet. Now he said, you see, it's only when there's something wrong that one will grieve and moan. Don't you understand, he said, there's something wrong, something out of order. Can that which is unsavory be eaten without salt? You know, there's a great crying out today, but don't take salt, keep off the salt. Well, if it does you any harm, keep off it. But I understand in the East, you wouldn't dare have put a friend down to the table without putting salt on the table. To put food to them without salt is like saying you're an enemy. They always put salt down to their friends. It was a sign of peace with them. Salt shaker had to be there. And then there are some things they would eat there that would be unsavory if they didn't have salt. They had to must have the salt. Now he said, look, something worse than that. For the arrows of the Almighty are within me, the poison whereof drinketh up my spirit. Now try and get that figure. He says, all you see is the outward thing of what I pass through. You know all about my outward sufferings. You know my material losses. You know that. You can see me sitting here and you can see my body. But there's one thing you don't know. You can't see what's happening inside. You see, his internal sufferings were worse than his external sufferings. He said, it's like this. God has let his arrows or his darts come at me. At least at this point, he comes to the conclusion that it's God that's working with him, but at that point he doesn't know why. Actually, you know, it wasn't God's darts, it was the devil's darts, under God's permissive will. But he said, the arrows of the Almighty are within me. They're not external, they're within me, they've got right in. And they're poison arrows. And the poison that was on these arrows are just sapping up my strength and dying. Poison whereof drinketh up my spirit. The terrors of God do set themselves in array against me. You see, he wants them to understand his internal feelings and sorrow. You know, beloved, sometimes a heavy heart can be hidden behind a smiling countenance. There are some people who would never let you know that they're passing through times of sorrow, times of suffering. They can always have the smile. They can always have the good morning. They can always have the handshake. But if you could get to know what's going on behind the scenes, you'll find they're passing through times of trouble. There's other people, and they're never out of trouble according to their idea. I've told you from this desk before about a lady that my wife and I knew, at least my wife knew her better than I did, because she used to come and work with my wife at the weekends on the Saturdays when they were busy. I often wondered how she put up with her even for a day. If I saw her on the street, I made it my business to get to the other side of the street before she would see me and look in a window till she was past. Because if you didn't, she would stop you. My, that's it. You had an organ recital. From the head to the sole of the foot. Something was wrong with her in every limb. I often felt sorry for her poor husband. Poor Johnny. He was a man who suffered from arthritis. And he did. You could see in his fingers and he had it in his shoulders. But went to his work every day. Poor fellow. But she was the one that thought she was sick. She never was well. Oh, she loved her sickness. She loved her pain. I often thought if she had it, she wouldn't have thought so much about it. What you need to do when you're like that is see somebody that's really sick. You know, a lot of people have a lot of pain. And you don't see it by looking at them. But they come through it. Ah, but you see, what's inside? Internal. Grief. Grief. Heart pain. Pain of the spirit. He said, that's what I'm passing through. But look what he says now. He comes to verse 8. Oh, that I might have my request. You remember what his request was back in chapter 3? And that God would grant me the thing that I long for. Even that it would please God to destroy me, that he would let loose his hand and cut me off. Then should I yet have comfort. Yea, I would harden myself in sorrow. Let him not spare, for I have not concealed the words of the Holy One. What is my strength that I should hope? What is mine end that I should prolong my life? Is my strength the strength of stones, or is my flesh of brass? Is not my help in me, and is wisdom driven quite from me? Stop there a moment. In that little section, he expresses again his desire to be relieved from the sufferings, but he wants to be relieved by an act of God. His wife said, now just you curse God and die. That's what Satan said he would do. But he wouldn't do it. And yet he's grieving here and he said, oh, it's so heavy on me. I can't take any more. And I said it already to you and I repeat it, he said. I just wish that by an act of God I could be relieved from all this suffering. If God would just take me away. Have you ever visited people who felt like that? Have you? I've known a few. They perhaps weren't so extreme as this man, but nevertheless they'd seen the life behind them, and they felt there was nothing more they could do in life. You see, at this point, Job thought he was suffering from a terminal disease. Man had no cure for it. And he said, far better if God would just take me now, rather than let me linger on like this. I'm longing for it. Because if God took me away, that would be a measure of comfort. I'd be out of it. Now, do you blame him for that? You see, again I want to emphasize at this point, Job did not know He was not conversant with what was going on behind the scenes. He didn't know the controversy between Satan and God. He didn't know that he was the target. He's yet got to learn it. And there's one thing that God's going to teach you. You see, as you go through this book, you learn there was one little fault with this man, and it was that one little fault that God was going to correct. He was too self-righteous. Too self-righteous. And he was going to be brought to the point where he would realize that he was no more righteous than anybody else. And he'll be prepared to say this. And he'll acknowledge it. Now look again at the requests that he makes. Look at verse 14. To him that is afflicted, pity should be shown from his friend. That's true, isn't it? A man is afflicted, pity should be shown from his friend. Now these men pretended to be his friends. They weren't showing him any pity. They were criticizing him. They were condemning him. They were giving him no comfort and no pity. But he forsaketh the fear of the Almighty. My brethren have dealt deceitfully as a brook. As a stream of brooks they pass away, which are blackish by reason of the ice, wherein the snow is hid. What time they wax warm, they vanish. When it is hot, they are consumed out of their place. The paths of their way are turned aside. They go to nothing and perish. The troops of Timah loop. The companies of Sheba waited for them. They were confounded because their hope. They came thither and were ashamed, for now ye are nothing. Ye see my casting down and are afraid. Did I say, bring unto me, or give a reward for me of your substance? Or deliver me from the enemy's hand? Or redeem me from the hand of the mighty? Teach me, and I will hold my tongue. Cause me to understand wherein I have erred. How forcible are right words. What doth your arguing prove? You see, he says, you've come here pretending to be my friends. But the fact of the matter is, you've showed me no pity. It reminds me, he said, of men who are in a wilderness. They're thirsty. And a thirsty man needs something to drink. And they see something that they think is water. It's only a mileage, of course. And they go to get the water. And when they get there, there's none. It's vanished. It's not there. You've come here supposed to be to give me comfort. But you're just like that. You've vanished. You've brought me no comfort. You haven't spoken a word of comfort. If you could speak and convince me of my error, I would keep quiet, I'd listen to you. You haven't convinced me of that. Now watch the closing little bit of this. Look at verse 25 again. How forcible are right words? What doth your argument reprove? Do ye imagine to reprove words and the speeches of one that is desperate, which are as wind? Yea, ye overwhelm the fatherless, and ye dig a pit for your friend. Now therefore be content. Look upon me, for it is evident unto you if I lie. Return, I pray you, let it not be iniquity. Yea, return again, my righteousness is in it. Is there iniquity in my tongue? Cannot my taste discern perverse things? See, Job is really letting go of them now. He wants them to speak the truth. He wants them to test them, but test them correctly. Put the correct level on them. If they're going to test them, let the test be according to divine standards. That's what they've failed to do. Now as he passes from there, he comes into chapter 7, and you've heard this passage taken out of context often, I'm sure. Here's Job speaking now, and he's thinking of the life he's living. He's thinking of men, and he is one of them. Is there not an appointed time to man upon the earth? Of course there is. That's a great truth. Many a good gospel message has been preached on that text. Is there not an appointed time to man upon earth? Are not his days also like the days of an hireling? As a servant earnestly desireth the shadow, that is, he desires night to come, so his day of service will come to an end, you'll get a rest. And as an hireling looketh for the reward of his work, he used to get paid at the end of every day, so am I made to possess months of vanity, and wearisome nights are appointed to me. When I lie down, I say, when shall I arise, and the night be gone? I am full of tossings to and fro unto the dawning of the day. My flesh is clothed with worms and clods of dust. My skin is broken and become loathsome. My days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle. By the way, I wonder how many of you here have ever seen a weaver's shuttle. I know this is a textile area, although we have no textile mills in Raleigh that I know of. But we used to have textile works around where I was born and brought up. It's an amazing thing to watch those shadows. How quickly they could pass from one side to the other. That shadow going back and forth, see? He takes that, he says, my days are swifter than a weaver's shuttle, and are spent without hope. Oh, remember that my life is wind. Mine eyes shall no more see good. He's dealing here with the brevity of life. Yet as you think of the brevity of life, and think of what this man has passed through in his life in his days of prosperity, he's ushered into the days of adversity. He's down sinking, as it were, in the deep mire of experience now. There doesn't seem to be any standing. There's no comfort for him. And he's thinking of it. Oh, he said, my days are brief. Life at its best is short. He's thinking of the brevity of life. Why is it that although life is so brief, there's some folk have to carry such heavy burdens? But he goes on from there. Look what he says now. Verse 12. Am I a sea or a whale that thou settest a watch over me? When I say my bed shall comfort me, my couch shall ease my complaint, then thou scarest me with dreams and terrifiest me through visions. Isn't that what the man said? He had had a vision of the night. God had given him a revelation. And it was this and it was that. So that my soul chooseth strangling, and death rather than my life, I loathe it. I would not live all this. Let me alone, for my days are vanity. What is man that thou shouldest magnify him? That thou shouldest set thine heart upon him, that thou shouldest visit him every morning, and try him every moment. How long wilt thou not depart from me? Let me alone till I swallow down my spit. Three words. He's asking now, is God against me? It's obvious you're against me. And it's obvious that you think God is against me. But now he's torn between two himself, and he's saying, now, is God against me? Is it God that's doing this to me? And if so, the man doesn't understand why. Because remember, you and I know why. Because we have chapters 1 and 2. Which Job, of course, didn't have at that time. That wasn't written then. It was only afterwards that he got to know what was going on. Now look at the appeal he makes. Look at verse 20. He begins to make his appeal. I have sinned. What shall I do unto thee, O thou preserver of men? Why hast thou sent me as a mark against thee, so that I am a burden to myself? Why dost thou not pardon my transgression? Take away mine iniquity, for now shall I sleep in the dust. Thou shalt seek me in the morning, but I shall not be. Plain words, he's making his appeal. He's saying that, well, O God, if you're against me, why prolong? If you're doing this because of my sin, all right, that's it. Why not finish now? Take me away. That's Job's answer to Eliphaz. And in his answer, he has answered, number one, positively, in order to show that his lament in chapter 3 was justified. And then negatively, so to speak, he's answering this in answer to the charges that have been laid against him. And the man is still down in the depth. He doesn't yet understand. The others are going to speak, and he'll have his answer for them. Our time's gone. Perhaps we'll bow in prayer. We'll ask our brother Larry Summerlin to dismiss us with a word of prayer.